The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you very much. This is the matter of Klingel, hope I pronounced this correctly, Klingelhutz versus Klingelhutz et al. We were supposed to start at 9:30. It is now 10 to 10. Mr. hope I pronounced his name right, Mr. Rather, counsel for the appellant, has not appeared. He is not called in. We have attempted to both call him and contact him by email with no results. In addition, it's come to our attention that the training session, which is available for attorneys prior to having the actual oral argument, was made available to him and he also did not appear. So based on this, the panel has decided to move forward. Mr. Kras, you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you. I do want to make sure you can hear me. All right. Thank you. And good morning. I'm Rod Kras, representing the respondent in this matter, which is a dispute among members of a family limited partnership over real estate that they own. There were six siblings. There are six siblings who are the children of the testators who created this partnership, and into which they placed two farms, an agricultural farm of 160 acres and a 70 acre farm, which is we call development property, ripe for development and presently being developed within the city of Chaska. The lawsuit shows Klingelhutz versus Klingelhutz. But like many family partnerships, this one works with a one person, one vote system, and everybody participates and gets to have a say in what is occurring, and particularly in these three sales, because the development property, I should note, was sold in two phases. So it's James on one side and all of the other siblings and partners on the other side.
Excuse me, Mr. Kras, I think you just said that everyone participates. I understood that only the three general partners may act on behalf of the partnership. Am I misunderstanding that?
You are reading correctly the partnership agreement. I have seen often that members of a family partnership don't always adhere to that. And the general partners, the three of them, have always included the other siblings in all of the decisions, even though that wasn't required. The general partners are still liable and responsible for making those decisions, I would add, under the agreement.
And while we're on that point, I have a question about paragraph 6.6 of the partnership agreement, which says, I might paraphrase a little bit, with ordinary matters may be decided by a majority of the general partners. Excuse me, I think it says any matters not in the ordinary course of business may be done, or I think they require the consent of all general partners. So there seems to be a distinction between ordinary matters on the one hand, and on the other hand, items not in the ordinary course of business. Am I correct that those two are mutually exclusive? And if so, what's the meaning of those terms?
We have, and the trial court did, interpret that particular section in conjunction with section 3.1, which provides that the purpose of the partnership is to lease, manage, own, sell, exchange the real property in the partnership. So that's the business of the partnership. It's the management and sale of this real estate, and those would be considered and were considered in the ordinary business matters of the partnership, included in that definition.
Thank you.
All right. Now, as you've seen from your reading, the gravamen of the complaint that James has is that all of his siblings decided to sell these properties in three parcels in what he calls a rock bottom amount, far below market value, grossly negligent and reckless. putting aside how implausible that theory is, given James' ownership of 19% and everybody else's together at 81%, there are two fatal defects to James' position. And the first deals with the total lack of evidence of any damages. He has not shown that anything the two other general partners at the time did in the sales in question, even though they were agreed to by all the other limited partners, were below market value. James did obtain an appraisal a year before the lawsuit was commenced, which determined that the market value of the developable land was $75,000 per acre for the acreage that could be developed. He did not, however, put that into evidence. The only way it got in is I used a summary in obtaining evidence from him at his deposition, but they never ratified it. They didn't include an affidavit from the appraiser or anything of that nature. The irony,
Mr. Kras, on that issue. So I understand the full appraisal is not in the record. We do have, I believe, a two-page cover letter from Marks to James, dated March 3 of 2017. It refers to the appraisal, and it includes on the second page the statement that the estimated market value is $5.1 million. I mean, isn't that some evidence of a value of the value of the property as of that date?
There's two problems with that. Number one, while the summary was used as a document in the deposition, it was never sworn to or adhered to by the appraiser. And that's a big problem. The second problem was, as the court pointed out, and as we pointed out, and as James admitted, the appraiser used the wrong acreage for the developable acreage. He thought it was 68 out of 70. It turned out to be 65%. James didn't give him that information as to what the city would allow. But perhaps more important, once we sold the two parcels which comprised Farm 2, we noted that we received $72,500 a developable acre. That's 97% of what the appraiser said. And I think that's the reason they didn't get an affidavit from him. That's all they had to do is to get it that into evidence, is have him ratify it in some manner with an affidavit. But it wouldn't do him any good.
And the dollars per acre that you're referring to, I don't see it in this four-page document that's Deposition Exhibit 15. Is it elsewhere in the record, or is it outside the record?
It is in the record. You'll find it in the argument for the summary judgment on page 37 and 38, as I recall. We discussed that because obviously the appraiser did not know how many acres were developable. James acknowledged that deficiency in his deposition. And so the appraisal, if good for anything, is good for the per acre price of the developable land. And we got 97% of the per acre price he put in his appraisal and presumably was willing to put in an affidavit. So it's pretty hard for them to claim that these are rock bottom prices and something was wrong with us for accepting them when we're getting 97% of what their appraiser thinks the developable acreage is worth.
Well, what is the fiduciary duty here, the fiduciary duty of a general partner in this situation of attempting to sell a major asset of a limited partnership? I mean, what are the extent of the duties in that situation?
I think that is a great question, Judge Johnson, and one that the plaintiff was required to answer and never did. We don't know what fiduciary duty we were supposedly being asked to meet. We don't know.
I mean, you could have, both parties could have addressed the law in their briefing, the law of fiduciary duty in general, fiduciary duty of a general partner of a limited partnership in Minnesota, and with application to these particular transactions. And I'm still kind of looking for more authority about that. And I guess, and also trying to envision how it applies to a sale of property. And I was planning on asking plaintiff's counsel is, you know, the mere fact that, you know, if a fact finder were to find that the property was worth 2% more than the sale price, is that sufficient in itself to prove a breach, or is a fiduciary not so strictly liable for a suboptimal result? Anyway, can you expand on that in any way?
I'm not sure I can add a great deal to that. Obviously, we've got a fiduciary duty to do our best to meet the requirements of the partnership and obtain for the partners what is appropriate. Look, maybe the way to answer it is this. In the sale of the agricultural land, we got an appraisal. We did extensive marketing with the two general partners. Then, at James' insistence, we listed it with a realtor he chose for 6 months, got a poor offer through that, took the property back, sold it ourselves without a realtor for a net of over $300,000 more than the realtor sale James pursued and wanted us to accept would have gotten. And I think whatever the possible measure is of a fiduciary duty, we met it. The developable property we had analyzed extensively by an expert in development in Chaska, former Chaska city manager for 30 years, who knew a great deal about what the city would expect and what the city would determine would be developable. He did an analysis for the sale to that independent third party, Traditions Development, also known as Club West, whose president was deposed and testified he bought it for market value. And
Ross, on this very point, I mean, I assume these sales were arm's length transactions, correct?
The sale of phase one to Club West was arm's length. The sale of the second phase went to one of the limited partnerships, one of the members of the limited partnership, which is authorized by the agreement that there can be self-dealing. And that was based, number one, on what Club West paid. In fact, the second phase sold for more per acre, developable acre, than the Club West property. And we got another appraisal.
My question is his sole basis for arguing there was a breach is that he thinks you should have gotten more money? Is there anything else? So there's no suggestion that there's some underhanded, under the table payoff or anything like that?
Judge Connolly, there was that pled. When it came to the proof, there was none.
Okay.
So those are the things we did in selling all three of those parcels. I don't know what more we could have done to meet our fiduciary duty, but that's a pretty extensive list of things we did to make sure we got top dollar, and everyone but James felt we did. And everyone but James agreed with those sales, all three of them. And actually, John, the brother that James points his finger at the most, was the one person in the partnership who said we shouldn't sell this, we should develop it because it's great property. We're going to make a lot more money if we do that. But his siblings were at retirement age. They wanted to get their money out of it, and they did not take John's advice and wanted to sell it. So that's how those two parcels ended up getting sold. And as I've indicated in my brief, getting back to Judge Johnson's question, it is the plaintiff's obligation, if they think we've breached a fiduciary duty to tell us what that is. I can't tell them what they think we did wrong. They have to tell us. And outside of saying we took too little money, they really didn't have anything else to say about that. And the court made a point that this is not something that under the case law that we've cited is an obvious item. You can't say that like theft or something of that nature from a partnership where you really don't need anybody to tell a trier of fact that that's wrong. You have to have some basis for trying to claim we breached our fiduciary duty. And as a result, that lack was a second fatal defect of the entire case that that they presented, that James presented. With no evidence that we sold any of these three parcels for below market rates, and with extensive evidence provided by us, not by them, that we in fact got market prices for all three of these parcels, James, as the trial court found, did not meet his burden and deserved to be dismissed, and we believe that decision deserves to be appealed. I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Krass. I will simply note for the record, during your argument, we've received no communications from counsel for the appellant. Therefore, this matter is submitted and you will receive our decision within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.